Welcome to the Dirt on the Past,
the Museum Edition,
a YouTube and podcast program of the Extreme History Project, which explores ancient and historical topics relating to artifact collections from the Museum of the Rockies right here in Bozeman, Montana.
At Extreme History, we explore the good, the bad, and the ugly about our human past because, let's face it, history isn't pretty. But it's so important to know because it's at the very thing that has led us to the most critical concerns in the present.
So join me, Nancy Mahoney.
And me, Crystal Alegria.
As we talk to archaeologists and historians who have been digging in the dirt.
And in the archives.
And in museum collections to uncover fascinating histories that are relevant to today's issues.
And can help us move forward with a deeper understanding of the past.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the show. I'm Nancy.
And I'm Crystal.
And we're the co-hosts of The Dirt on the Past. This week, we're coming to you from the E.L. Wiegand Digital Learning Studio at the Museum of the Rockies. We are in a collaboration with the Museum of the Rockies here in Bozeman, Montana, to bring you this new version of the podcast called The Dirt on the Past Museum Edition. And this allows us to record video as well as audio. So if you're just hearing us on podcast, you can also find us on YouTube, right?
Yeah. Correct.
Okay, fantastic. So we're very excited because this week we're joined by New York Times bestselling author Mark Sullivan, and he's going to be talking about his book, The Last Green Valley. So welcome, Mark. We're so excited to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Glad to have you.
So, Mark, this book is especially interesting to us because you're following a family that has resided here in Bozeman for over 50 years
That's right.
And they had a harrowing escape from World War II Ukraine, caught between Germans and Russians, and then even having to escape out of Germany at some point, and they eventually end up in Bozeman, Montana. So that's not a spoiler. I think that's on the book. But just so you know, there is that happy ending to look forward to, but there's a lot that goes on in this book. But we like to start off by telling our listeners and our viewers a little bit about our guests. So I'm going to do that. Mark Sullivan is the acclaimed author of 20 novels, including Beneath a Scarlet Sky, which has been published in 37 languages. That is impressive. As well as All the Glimmering Stars, which is his new book that debuts in May. He's also written the number one New York Times bestselling private series with James Patterson and has received numerous accolades for his writing. Mark grew up in Medfield, Massachusetts, and graduated from Hamilton College with a BA in English before volunteering with the Peace Corps in Niger, West Africa. Upon his return to the United States, Mark earned a graduate degree at the, Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, and then began a career in investigative journalism. As an avid skier and adventurer, Mark lives with his wife here in Bozeman, Montana. So welcome.
We're well, so thank happy you to again have for you. Having me. I appreciate
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and we're glad to have you in person as well. So yeah, that's great. So Mark, as Nancy said, this book follows the Martell family. And it is just such a wonderful book about this family's trek. And it is historical fiction. It is not nonfiction, but right. It is true to the story and the real experiences of this family. And this family includes Emil Martell, the father, right. Adeline, the mother, Bill and Walter, the two sons, yeah. as well as their extended families. But yeah. we're going to be kind of talking about the family itself today. Right. And their immigration experience in 1944 as they fled Stalin's movement into the Ukraine, assisted by the Nazis, since they were actually pure blood Germans. And we'll get back to how that all that.
Yeah.
How that'll we'll get back we'll get right. back to that and this book follows the Martell's family's really it's a horrific journey yeah. with the endpoint being Bozeman, so it's kind of exciting to be talking about this story here in Bozeman, so right. we're excited to talk with you about it. So can you tell us a little bit about the origin story of this book and what really inspired you to write it?
Well, after I finished Beneath the Scarlet Sky and it published and it was a success, all these people started telling me I'd never find another story like it. And I was like, no, you know, I actually think
you
I
were
will.
Confident.
I was pretty confident. Okay. I was pretty confident there were other stories that I could tell. And I was one of the few people who could tell them. I always confident. And about 6 months after Beneath was published, I was doing an event in Bozeman to the Noontime Rotary, talking about the book, and retired dentist comes up afterwards and says, you know, these people in town, the Martells. And I said, I know who they are, but I don't know them.
Because they own a huge construction company.
I was just going to say, all of us know the Martell name. Right. Yeah. The family. So to find out that there's this story attached to it is incredible.
Yeah. So he said, the entire time I was reading your book, all I could think of was the story of how they came to America. You need to hear this story. So he was adamant. And so anyway, I agreed. And a couple of days later, I put my, into my nav, is that Bill Martell's address? And it's like 2 miles from my house. And then I turned into the little neighborhood where he lives. And I'm getting this bizarre feeling, and I can't quite figure it out until I get to his driveway. And then I realized I can't be 200, 250 yards from where I heard Beneath the Scarlet Sky.
And the, like, the story that kind of inspired that book.
Yeah, the story that inspired that book at the at that dinner party.
Yeah.
So anyway, I go and I meet with Bill and one of his daughters, and he starts telling the story. And within 10 minutes, you know, I'm sitting forward in my chair, and within an hour and a half of talking to him, I know I'm doing it, because it's hitting all these things that I've been looking for, this criteria that I developed after Beneath the Scarlet Sky. And I was looking for stories that were A, untold, or B, not told well. But the biggest thing is I believed that they had to be inherently moving, inspiring, you know, healing to some people, potentially transformative to other people. And I got that in spades in the first hour and a half of listening to the, you know, the Martells tell the story. So I was all in, you know, at that point. And, you know, it took me about 2 years to do the research and to understand enough about that world and what was going on in what we now call Ukraine, between before, you know, Hitler came and after. And that really took a long time for me to get settled in my head. But once I did, I was in a good position to go to the Ukraine with the Martells, which is what we did.
That's which amazing. Is incredible. And as we were just discussing before we started the podcast, you were able to do that really right before the pandemic hit, before COVID shut everything down.
Summer before.
So there was just this amazing, I think, you found the story at the right time. You were able to do the research.
Yes.
And Bill and William are still around and able to make Walter. That trip with you. Walter. Walter. That's just amazing. William is his brother, I think, right? No, it's absolutely incredible. So let's talk a little bit about some more of the elements that are in this book, because you said you had to do a lot of research. And for me, this was so interesting, aside from even the amazing story that it was, but just to have this window into World War II from a completely different perspective, to be on the other side, to be having Stalin risen to power, what's going on with Hitler. And then they're sort of in this perfect storm, having been of German descent, but living in Ukraine. And we'll get to some of that. But so this family, the Martells, and we're going to be talking about Emil and Adeline and their sons, but hundreds of families that experienced this long trek to leave Ukraine during the middle of World War II, caught between Nazis and Russian forces. So I think you say about 350,000 ethnic Germans.
Ethnic Germans were evacuated over the course of about a year and a half. But this one was the big run. This was about 130,000 in the long line that they were in. So imagine during a war, you're in the equivalent of a Conestoga wagon. Right, for people in the West.
We just did a podcast on the Oregon Trail and the Bozeman Trail coming out west.
Same kind of
thing. Sounded like the same conditions, worse because you're being bombed.
Yeah.
And the artillery. Oh my word.
Right. And there's high powered, you know, weapons being used everywhere. And they're in this little wagon with two horses pulling them and their two kids and everything they could put in there.
And say a little bit about this being an evacuation to ultimately get to Poland.
What happened was Hitler invades Ukraine in June of 43, and he immediately expulses and drives the Russians back and out, but he drives too far, and then we have Stalingrad. And Stalingrad really stopped that halt that winter. And then Stalin turns around and counterattacks. And by this point, the Nazis, you know, their army had been somewhat decimated. But at the same time, they're starting to institute the final solution, right? This, in Ukraine, you have what was called the Holocaust of Bullets. It was when they first started actively killing Jews and in the open doing it. And so all this was in the mix, and you have in the middle of it this family that's literally been in Ukraine for over a century, right? They have little or no ties to Germany other than they speak German, and most of them are Lutherans, and that their towns look like Bavaria, that they build these little colonies. But that was it until Hitler comes. And by this time, they've all been thrown off their land. Right, by Stalin's forces.
You had kind of them when they moved into Ukraine originally. It wasn't this horrible, difficult situation.
No.
And then you have, like you said, they have these beautiful villages. When does Stalin? Do you know when Stalin takes over?
Yeah, so you know, there's the Bolshevik Revolution at 17, and very swiftly afterwards, they developed this term called kulaks, which were people who were actually competent at something, right? Someone who was a successful merchant or a doctor or whatever, any kind of intellectually smart person was deemed a kulak. And by their very nature, they were, you know, basically, you know, oppressing the masses.
It's one of these tactics we see over and over again in these regimes where anybody who's smart, talented, or might question the authority is rounded up and
they're suspect, right?
Yeah,
and so the Martels got thrown off their land after a century. They starved at one point during Stalin attempts to starve the Ukraine, and 4 million people die. This is in the early 30s. And Mr. and Mrs. Martel both starved. You know, they remembered it distinctly. I've heard recordings of them talking about it, eating grass to survive. It's just mind-boggling when you think about it. And so they'd already endured all this stuff by the time Hitler invades. And the first thing Hitler says, do you want your land back? And they think, well, yeah, we want our land back. And so they go and they get about 16 months, right? They start and they start planting, they rebuild their house, they do all these things. And then Stalin counterattacks. And then they have a choice. The Germans show up on their door and say, you can be protected, but you got to come with us, and we're leaving in 72 hours. So what are you going to do? And of course, they decide to run. They have an ulterior motive. They want to run all the way to freedom.
They want to keep going.
They want
to
keep going.
There wasn't really, they didn't see an option to stay that looked like it was ever going to be. And they had experienced life under Stalin before. So there was nothing there for
both
them.
Both parents, both fathers. Adeline's father gets taken by the Stalinists and vanishes in Siberia. Never hear from him again. Mr. Martel's father gets sent to the mines in Siberia and emerges a broken man. So they knew what was coming, that because they, you know, had gotten their lands back from the Germans, they were probably going to be killed or end up in Siberia. So they took the lesser of two evils and they ran. And this is one of the things that really interested me about the story, is that again and again and again, as in Beneath the Scarlet Sky, these people are presented with no good option. You know, either way, bad, but one seems to get them closer to freedom. And that's,
well, they had an idea of something they actually wanted, and they had an idea of American way. And it seemed like that was what guided so many decisions that they had to make where there was no good option,
right?
Because they kind of had this idea and this hope, which is fascinating. So for some of the research, you talked to people who had been on this long trek, aside from Emil and Adelaide, the recordings that you heard, and their sons. So tell us a little bit about what that was like and what you learned from.
Well, I was able to find actually through the Martels, because they knew people who had come over who ended up in the United States also. So I was able to talk to them. And they were had vivid memories of the trek. And then I went to try to recreate the trek. So I went to, you know, Ukraine afterwards, but the first place I went was Romania. I had promised my wife I wouldn't go into conflict zones anymore. So I didn't go into Moldova, which was experiencing a lot of civil unrest at the time. So I picked them up right on the border in Barlad. And I always hire guides. I'm a big fan of guides. And I looked for guides who have a either a journalism background or a historical background, because they speak my language like right away and they know what I'm looking for. So I said, can you find people who would be alive who remember this, right? And they're all going to be in their 80s and up. They have to be 70s, 80s and up. And I was stunned when they found 9.
Wow.
And that's a lot. That's impressive.
That is a lot. And they did it all through the Romanian National Museum.
They had
gone out and interviewed these people at various times, and other historians had interviewed them. So we had a lead right away. We went to this town on the border, and one of the first people we meet is this guy, Gheorghe Vasilescu, who is a Romanian national hero, and little guy, but beamed, right? Right when I met him, he was 96, 97 when I met him.
Wow.
He's still alive.
He's still living.
Alive. He's still alive. Wow. And he was very sharp and very emotional when he talked about it. But he described how he had been, you know, in the Battle of Stalingrad and blew up and woke up and understood deep in his heart that he was going to survive to become, of all things, a beekeeper.
So and he becomes like a...
He's an integral character in the book. There's no evidence whatsoever that they met him. But because of something that happens later, and I'll talk about it in a couple of minutes, he becomes integral. And because he tells me that he had not only survived Stalingrad, but retreated, but then was taken by the Soviets, thrown into a prison camp, escaped, thrown into another one, escaped, thrown into another one, escaped, finally gets thrown into this high security one in the Crimea, and he spends 4 years in the mines, and he survives because deep in his heart he believes he's going to be a beekeeper.
It's amazing.
I love that character.
I love that. But and how amazing to keep surviving these. I mean, just the toll it takes on your body, and mining can be so difficult.
Oh, yeah.
And then he has also that vision of what he's going to be.
Vision of who he's going to become.
Yeah,
and the vision sustains him because he comes back and he does become a beekeeper, and he believes that eating royal jelly, bee royal jelly, and getting stung and eating honey every day of his life was responsible for his longevity, and he outlived 3 wives.
Wow. Wow. Looking for his fourth.
Yeah.
I know. That's amazing.
I think he was.
I know, right? Yeah. I'm sure he's probably a catch still. I know.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So, you know, that, and then I met other people who had been, you know, actually there. Ended up staying in Romania and in Hungary. They only made it so far, and they ditched off the train that was going all the way. They didn't go all the way to the Worthgau, but that's where most people ended up, which was basically the Ellis Island of the Third Reich,
which was so interesting. I know that was a whole other
until I started researching it, and until Bill and Walter started telling me what it was like to be there. It was an amazing.
So they were already looking to bring back people. And as you said, I guess they're implementing the final solution, which is horrific when it comes to the Jews. And part of it, I didn't realize, was bringing back.
They believed that the ethnic Germans in what we would call the Soviet Union because they lived in those tight little colonies, and they used to intermarry between colonies. They believed that they were the purest Aryan blood on earth. For whatever warp reason.
They had left that 100 years before.
That's right.
And had just stayed in these little colonies.
Yes.
And so they were bringing them back.
They had such a bizarre fascination
with this idea of purity. And,
yes.
It's such scary rhetoric when you even hear anyone refer to that.
So they, after this long trek that they go on, they come back, and Emil and Adeline and the extended family are separated. And Emil is taken to a prison camp. Adeline is kind of taking care of everybody, her 2 children who are, am I right in this, 4 and 6 years old at the time?
At the very beginning, they're 4 or 6.
Okay.
By the time this split happens, they're more like maybe almost 8 and 6,
I was trying to figure that out and couldn't quite do it, but and so they are processed as refugees by the Nazis at this location that we talked about, and they are given clothes to wear, they're given a place to live, and they find out, Adeline kind of finds out, that these clothes belong to Jewish community members who are no longer there. They're either
so did the houses.
Dead or at a prison camp or at Auschwitz or somewhere like that.
Right.
And so then, you know, what a moral dilemma that they're in.
No good choices.
No again, good, choices. Good choices.
Trying to survive. Horrifying. And all of a sudden, horrifying. Yeah. When they start to understand the ramifications of,
because they haven't even been part of that Nazi, like they haven't been voting for Emil the leadership has, part
right?
of it.
I mean, okay. This is one of the things about the story that, I had learned from a granddaughter that Adeline said that right at the beginning when they went back to Friedenstahl, that little village where that colony where they lived had lived, you know, traditionally the family, Emil decides to go to the closest town and get roofing supplies so he can finish their house so they can be tight before winter comes. And this is in September. So, and he goes, and he's supposed to be gone a day, and he's gone like four. And he comes back and he's as rattled and shaken as Adeline has ever seen him. And she asked what happened. And he said he was held by the Germans and he was forced to bury Jews. Mm. And I was like shocked, and I did a bunch of research to make sure, you know, went to the U.S. Holocaust Museum, went to Yad Vashem, I got sources in there from the first book. And I said, you know, where would this have happened? And then, you know, the consensus would have been Dubasari, which was this town about 15, 18 kilometers away.
So not that far.
That far. It would have been where he would have gone to get those kind of supplies. And indeed, in the same time frame, there was a massacre of Jews in Dubasari. And, but, you know, people have asked me, how did you deal with writing about this?
Yeah.
And was it difficult on you? And I was like, yeah, it was very difficult. I would come downstairs after doing research, trying to piece the whole thing together. And I'd look at my wife and go, this is some of the most brutal stuff I've ever had to deal with.
Because then also to write these characters, Mark, you have to put yourself in their place when you're trying to convey. And that's where I feel like the emotional toll, because it's emotional as a reader, and you're not going to get that unless you're having to put yourself in that mental and emotional space.
That's right. Yeah, and that's the difficult thing, but it's the necessary thing. It's not easy to get in the minds of people who have no qualms about killing Jews, but I had to get in their minds. I had to understand how they worked at that time, in that place, based on all the evidence that was available, because Emil spoke like almost nothing about it, but it haunted him like for years until he goes obviously into the POW camp and has, you know, an awakening. But when I was working on all this stuff, I just kept telling myself, go right at the thing that scares you most. Wow. Just do it.
Yeah.
I mean, he did. Yeah. Emil had to face that. Yeah. So I had to too. And those are some of the most moving parts of the book, you know.
I think we all imagine ourselves in the place of either Emil or Adeline in several cases, and thinking how you would be feeling about that horror. And then what I was saying earlier about Emil and Adeline not being a part of like the rise of the Nazi regime in Germany, where it's this slow and they're part of seeing Hitler being voted in and taking over, but then to be so confronted with that at a point when you know you still don't have a choice, you've still got to go that direction.
Yeah,
it's got to be horrifying.
Yeah, it is, because they were, you know, they were living a horrified life to begin with. And then to find out that, oh yeah, these Germans that are coming, they're no better.
Right.
You know, in many ways they're worse.
Worse.
You know, or you know, they're no better at best. And that's a difficult thing. So then it becomes every man for himself. And so they said, yes, we want our land back. Yes, we want to survive. And you had to have been to this place. It's very remote. And I went there with Bill and Walter. And that was some of the more extraordinary moments that really informed the book, because I got to go back to Friedenstahl, which is now called Tyrady. It's not far from Dubasari, if you look at it on the map. You can see the road he must have taken to go there to get the roofing supplies. And we actually found the ruins of their house, because there was a plot plan that showed the property. And we found the root cellar that the boys had remembered and the well that they remembered. And being there with them, you know, this is where the book starts, right?
Right.
They're getting water from that well and they're about to run. And so I bring them all the way back and I get to go with them. So for them to confront the improbable arc of their life.
Right.
Start here and you're running and you've got nothing. And to end up in Bozeman, Montana, you know, these guys who founded this, helped found this incredibly successful company and lived the American dream from the time they got here on.
Mark, had they been back before that you took them?
Bill had been back to Germany, but not Ukraine.
Not Ukraine. I know. So they hadn't been back to their home. Let's take a look at the trek then and where, you know, it is that they started. Because I think this is so powerful. Do you need your glasses? Because I probably need mine. but we'll zoom in a little bit. Yeah. So we've got a pretty good view of it there. So we're talking about now Ukraine is kind of at this point still part of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, right. And so, but now it's being controlled by the Nazis when the thing starts. So they're here, right in this area. It's very close to the border. There's Dubasari, I think that's what that says. And this is their route.
This is the long trek, is that right? So this is where hundreds of wagons and over 130,000
people
are
between the two armies, and sometimes caught in battle.
I mean, look how far away Poland and Germany are from this. I mean, this is insane.
There's it's about 1600 miles that they go in the carts. And then of course the worst thing happens. They're almost to freedom and Stalin's coming, the Americans coming, they want to run. And right when it looks like they can run for the Allied lines, the American lines, he's taken prisoner, Mr. Martell, and then sent all the way back 1,800 miles.
Farther back than either,
to a place called Poltava.
Horrifying. Which is,
and we went there. We couldn't get there because it was up a worse road than it was to get to Friedenshall. And that had beaten up these two old men. So I chartered a plane and we flew. And we landed and we went, and Mr. Martell was held in the basement of a museum that had been bombed by the Allies when Poltava was an airfield for the Germans.
Okay, got it.
So that place was pretty much destroyed when they go there, and they take 2,700 to 3,000 prisoners there to start rebuilding this city. And it's horrific conditions. There's no good sanitation. People start dying almost immediately. And Mr. Martell lives in the basement of this bombed out thing, and there are men dying all around him. During the day, he rebuilds the hospital, and he finds he can make some money by gathering scraps of wood and selling it to the cooks. And this becomes critical because he's able to get a nest egg from when he actually tries to escape and he makes his run.
That's the thing about this book too. Hearing all these small things where they could keep the means going because they had this vision that they're going to be able to get out. They're going to be able, and everything along the way makes that difference.
It's just these little things that happen.
Yeah.
And then so we go there, and the museum has been rebuilt, and the hospital's there, and the city hall's there. And we go to the door of the museum, and it's closed for renovations.
Oh, no.
And we're like, no. So we go all around knocking on doors. And out somebody goes and gets the director of the museum, and he's highly suspicious of these three Americans and a Ukrainian translator guide. And we're telling him that we really love to see the museum. It's like, it's impossible. You know, it's under renovations, everything. We came all the way here to see it.
I have these.
Yeah, but then Walter's very gregarious, and he starts telling the guy how his dad used to pick up scraps of wood and sell it to the cook. And the guy got this big grin on his face. He goes, "My mother was one of the cooks you're in." And he takes us, and we go into the basement where Emil survived, you know, this horrific experience. And again, to be with the brothers, when they're confronting the reality of what their dad did.
They hadn't seen this.
No.
Yet. Right.
No, yeah. They had never been there. They had heard about it. And there they were in the actual room where he was held with hundreds of other men. And I can tell you, it was emotional for them. It was emotional for me. And it was then that I really began to understand the value and the motivation of freedom was in that room.
If he hadn't gotten it, he probably would have died
there. Yeah, if he hadn't gotten out, he would have died.
And you said that 3,000 came in, and then only what, 200?
280 place? when he ran. Yeah,
when he ran, yeah. There was only 280 left.
Yeah. I mean, it's brutal.
It's conditions. Brutal.
Yeah. It seems like all these places during the war, and that's the thing, there were so many little stories that are huge stories for the people that are in them.
Yeah.
But it's just, there's not enough to even treat these prisoners decently like humans. And
part of it was because the city was destroyed. It had gone from a city of 350,000 people to 6,000. So there was nothing there. People were just eking out a survival when Emil was there, you know. But it was interesting when we were leaving Ukraine, and I was going on to Poland and Germany with Walter, and Bill had to go home. He had a prior commitment, and we're sitting in the airport in Kyiv. And I said, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but up till the time your dad goes into the POW camp, he survives by not being noticed. He survives because he survived under Stalinism, where if you're good at anything, you're immediately suspect. So he was always keeping his head down, never being too good, you know, and never giving him a reason to send him to oblivion. But I said, correct me if I'm wrong, but he comes out of the prison camp a completely different person. He's a risk taker. He starts doing everything that, you know, a guy who was timid before would not have done. And I said, something changed him. What do you think it was? And he'd go, there's no doubt that he changed in there. He didn't talk a lot about it, but you just look at the evidence and you're right. Bill said it was always his opinion that his father met someone inside the prisoner of war camp who changed his philosophy of life, who made him a risk taker. And because he does this the rest of his life, he doesn't hesitate to take massive risks again and again and again, and it all pans out. But Bill said, we don't know. You're going to have to make it up who this guy was. And it was instantaneous. I knew who it was. It was the beekeeper.
Yeah.
And, you know, he transforms
that powerful effect on you that you could imagine. I mean, and I want to ask you a question about that later, because I think it's an interesting part of the process of bringing this story to life. But I want to continue a little bit and just talk about Adelaine for a minute, because she's a wife, she's a mother, and she has to, when they're separated, carry on.
That's right.
Keeping her two sons together, keeping them positive, keeping them safe.
Yes.
And she has to make a decision, which this is a gripping part of the book for me. Understanding what it must be like to be faced with this decision to then try to get out of East Germany, now controlled by Russians, where again, she's not going to have a possibility of really having a good life, but also she has the possibility of being reunited with her husband and having their story continue and getting freedom. So she has to make this horrifying decision, and she has two young boys, and it's not, there's no safe, easy way.
No, again, it's one of these quandaries. And I always say that that was the most difficult decision she ever made. And the second most difficult decision she makes is she walks away from her mother and her sister.
Right.
And she knows she's never going to see him again. And yet she does it because she shares Emil's dream of freedom. And she knows if she stays where her mother wants to stop, she won't get it.
Yeah.
Right.
And Emil had told her when he was taken, go as far west as you can and I'll find you. And so she walks away from her mother shortly after Emil is taken, and she's pulling everything they've got now is down to this little wagon.
Right.
That it was a mock-up of the actual, you know, covered wagon, but it was tiny. And Emil built it for the boys as a toy. And it becomes the thing that they walk through the aftermath of the war, pulling this, you know, along with, I can't remember, an ungodly number of refugees, 20 million are expelled out of all the Russian territories. And they're all walking towards Germany. And then, you know, she gets all the way there and she ends up in the wrong place. You know, she's not savvy enough to realize that she wanted to be with the British, the French, or the Americans. She ends up with the Soviets. She can't believe it.
I know. And I just have to ask, the interaction between her and the conductor on the train.
Real.
Oh, okay. I don't want to spoil it for anybody.
Yeah, no, real.
I'm gonna leave it there.
She talked a lot about that in these tapes.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, I've heard about that, and how she bribed him with cigarettes and booze. And yeah, and they got off, you know, the train at the last stop before the frontier were dividing Soviet from British, which is what, who were on the other side. And Walter and I went there. We re-walked the route. The town had fundamentally not changed.
Wow.
We found this diagonal alley that they walked through.
Yeah, you talk about that.
Yeah, to get to this lane. And there was this shed for firewood where they hid. It was still there. I mean, obviously it had been rebuilt and everything. But
they remembered it.
They remembered where it was.
Oh, and, wow. That just gives me the shivers.
Oh, I know. Yeah. And to think that actually where they crossed became one of the most heavily fortified parts of the Berlin Wall and the Iron Curtain.
I was going to ask about that.
It was. Yeah. But after the fall of the Soviet Union, the Germans and the reunification of Germany, they tore all that out and they restored it. So when I was there, it looked largely like it must have looked for them, with these lanes going out through crop fields and some trees and forests and stuff. And so Walter and I got there, and you know, he was able to say, well, here came the milk cart telling us to hide. We hid in here.
No.
And everything, Adeline talks about this in the thing, is that they were denied water. If they had been paused for water, they would have walked right into the Soviet patrols. If the guy in the milk cart hadn't come to tell them where to hide, they would have been caught by the Soviets and turned back. And you know, who knows what would happen, because they were killing people trying to go. And then she makes the bravest decision, most courageous decision of her life. And the second that Soviet patrol got out of sight, she starts to run with the boys. And she no sooner starts to run than the wheel falls off on the wagon, and she picks up.
That's where I think your superhuman motherly powers kick in.
Absolutely.
And the way you describe it, and the way she, I mean, I just know that feeling of collapsing at the end when you just can't, you're finally you just magically cross into state. But then hearing afterwards that it was, they thought that she had already been
cleared.
They
thought she'd had her papers checked by the Soviet patrol, and no one came after her.
But she became superhuman, and she ran, and she picked that up, and she just went.
Yeah.
She had to physically run with that wheel not working.
Right.
That was crazy to me that she did that. And the boy, and you know, towing two boys, and I don't know, did the boys really know what was happening in that moment?
Yeah.
Did
they knew
know
it was dangerous.
It was very dangerous.
Well, they were hearing shots.
Oh yeah.
People were being shot for trying to escape.
Oh.
So and for us to do that and to actually see where they came out and find this little park where, you know, this guy who chased them, caught up to them, and they find out that they were basically, you know, protected.
Right.
You know,
right.
But to make that run, what courage that took.
Huge.
Right. I just can't imagine.
Yeah. I couldn't, you know, that was one of the scenes that sealed the deal with making me want to write the book. When I found out about that, I was like, well, wait, what? You know? So.
Yeah. I know that to me was the most poignant part of the book, and the hardest to read as well.
Sure.
But thank goodness she got across that run and they made it. So that was wonderful. So we have a question here, and we've talked about that. So Nancy, I'll let you come to your next question.
Oh, I thought you were going to take that for me, but I can take it.
You can take it.
All right, I'll take it. And we talked about this a little bit earlier, that the family, they make it across, there's more to the story, and then they finally get to Eastern Montana, which I was very sad about. Because they live there
nothing
for a time. I know. And someone's gonna call me out on that. And I actually went through Baker, right, to
which
get
is where they landed.
Which is yeah. where they yeah. landed. Eventually. We went down yeah. to Ekalaka, and that whole area is it's stunning. Beautiful. And that whole area is beautiful. Yeah. It is gorgeous. But just the particular time they were there and the conditions and
September,
not having a place
snowstorm.
Of their own and having horrible. To live with an uncle and aunt, there's a lot that has to happen there. And then a couple of things happen that finally bring them to Bozeman.
Right.
And I love that part of the story, but tell us a little bit about how they get from Baker ultimately to Bozeman.
So yeah, they get to Baker and they have a gig on this farm that was promised to them because the farmer's whose relative son had been drafted for the Korean War. Mm-hmm. And so they go off and he 4Fs for, I can't remember why, but he gets disqualified from serving. And so he comes home. And the relative says to Emil, you're gonna have to go to into town, move out and get a job. And he goes into town. He finds out that they're building the first medical clinic in Baker. And he goes up and he asks for a job. And the guy says, well, the only job we have is mixing cement. Do you know anything about it? And he said, yeah, I mixed cement in a Soviet prisoner of war camp before I escaped. And the guy went, wait a second, you escaped from a Soviet prisoner of war camp? Because I did. Because you're hired.
Yeah. Yeah, that was yeah. that's right. the beginning of this whole new story.
Right.
Yeah.
And he goes to work. And
not
works.
Only did he mix cement, he did it and perfected it.
Perfected.
Yeah,
in the prison
exactly.
camp.
Right. He really knows how to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. He really amazing. Knows how to do it. Yeah. And especially in the cold.
Yeah.
Which sorry. Is what's going on. And yeah. he works and they start paying him and he can't believe it. And within like 3 months, and they all went to work. Adeline gets a job
right.
as a maid, working for like 10 cents an hour. Bill gets a job sweeping out the Baker movie theater, and Walter gets a job at a butcher shop. And the whole deal is every cent goes into the thing. And within 3 or 4 months, they make enough money to buy a quarter acre of land.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And then they make enough to dig a foundation, a poor foundation. And I think it's before the second winter, they get a subflooring on the top and they live in this basement in a hole in the ground with.
Still though, like after everything they've been through,
right.
it's like, wow,
right.
you know, this is
right.
ours.
But it's theirs.
Yeah.
yeah.
We
so,
all know that feeling. That
right.
is incredible.
So.
Do you know, sorry to interrupt you, but before I forget to ask, do you think that house is still there?
It is still there.
It is still there. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
It
yeah, that would be something to
and
go
the
visit.
The clinic, the build, clinic building
the clinic
is still
is
there.
Still there. That's incredible.
Superseded by a hospital.
Sure.
But yeah. But yeah, that's the thing is he works and they all work and they soon have their own home. And there's one scene that I just love in the book where Walter comes home and tells his parents that you know, when they slaughter pigs, they basically toss the heads out and they're horrified and they say, well, can you get the heads? And Walter says, I can ask. And he comes home with a sack of 3 hog heads in it, and they start making head cheese and cooking
all
it.
The, yeah.
And they can't believe that people are giving away free food. And Emil says, you know, I went to sleep in Montana and I woke up in hog heaven.
So cute.
Which I thought
cute.
Was hilarious.
So funny.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, yeah. I love that.
But then this happens again and again. And they're amazed by the abundance that and how all of a sudden they're becoming affluent. They own their own home.
Then there's a car in the driveway.
Yeah.
And,
all,
and
then
you're like, oh,
he
yay.
Gets a car because he has to, you know, he has to go out to these other work sites once because the guy who hires him to build the medical clinic, he's blown away. This guy's a machine, right? And
right.
so he starts hiring from other projects and he has to own a car. So he buys a car, off he goes. And
incredible.
Adeline, you know, packs his stuff and makes him enough food for a week and off he goes. And during the whole time, the boys are studying. And 5 years after they land, Walter graduates as the valedictorian.
I mean, that's
amazing.
I know,
yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
fluent in English, successful
yeah.
in school. And
yeah.
I think it's interesting because Bill and Walter seem to have different personalities that way regarding
Very.
School. And Bill's been incredibly successful, but school was not his thing.
No, he
yeah.
didn't like school. He didn't like to sit still. He wanted to make things happen. Mm. He liked working alongside his dad building stuff. And Walter wanted to design things. So he applies out of Baker High to two schools. One is the University of Chicago School of Architecture, which is where like Frank Lloyd Wright went.
Phenomenal. Yes.
And Montana College at the time. I call it Montana State because
it's too confusing.
It's too confusing.
Exactly.
Yeah. He applies to both places and he gets into both of them. And he and his parents go to Chicago and they take one look at where the University of Chicago is and they say, there's no way we're moving here. So they go back and they, Walter's finishing his exams and Bill has to be looked after because Bill has kind of a wild streak. And Adeline and Emil drive to Bozeman to see the school because they vowed they would never be apart.
I loved that, how they all go to Chicago and then they're like, nope, this isn't going to work for all of us. Right. Okay, so let's all go look at Bozeman.
Yeah. Right. And mom and dad go look at it. And it's this painting, this painting that Adeline used to tell the boys about. She had seen it in the house of this woman she used to cook for. And it was a painting of this beautiful green valley.
And that also made me cry because I've seen those wildflowers and those views and I've had those days, those emotions where you're like, this is why you live in Montana. I mean, there's lots of different seasons, but especially one of those when the storm clears.
Yeah. And spring happens and there's all these rainbows that happen.
Yeah.
And they do happen.
Yeah.
They do.
I didn't have to make it up.
No, I know.
But that was they basically said they would never leave.
And so they moved to Bozeman, the whole family,
right.
And they settled here and they lived here till the ends of their lives.
Yeah. And
Adeline and Emil.
Yeah.
Emil founds a construction company. He ends up buying these little lots on Third Street, builds them because they're close to the Dutch Reformed Church. And he has this idea in his head that all these guys out in Manhattan, Montana, and Amsterdam, Montana are retiring. They're going to want to come into town. They're going to want to be near their church. He's dead on. He sells them all and the company's up and going. And within 15 years of arriving, Emil's boys buy him out.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And he retires.
Yeah.
Right. He didn't understand what retirement was.
They
gave it to him and he takes the money. He goes out and buys a gold Cadillac and
was that in the 70s?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what my dad bought. Oh, 60s. Okay. My dad did it in the 70s. I was like, because I think my dad too, it was like, that's when you really made it. You could buy a Cadillac.
So he drives around Bozeman with his Cadillac with his fishing rod sticking out the window.
Love it.
That's great.
It's a beautiful story.
It is.
And it's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it is a great story. And it was so fun to read it, but as we come to the end of our discussion, Mark, can we talk about the importance of writing historical fiction and why it is important to write this?
Well, people always say, why don't you write it as nonfiction?
And
I always say, then I'm just giving you the facts. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give you what it was like to be there. And this is my depiction. This is my interpretation of what happened based on all the research and based on, everything I could find. And this distinction was given to me probably about 20 years ago now by an agent who was not and is not my agent, but she's very smart. And I was describing my dilemma with Beneath the Scarlet Sky and not being able to nail down everything because I intended to write it like I'm broken.
Had been a journalist background, so right for
I could
you.
Do it. Right? Yeah. But she said, Mark, I was, expressing frustration. She said, if this had come to you 15, 20 years ago, when you were a journalist, I would say, you're out of luck. There's some stories that don't go, but it came to a novelist and a very good one. And there's something that a novelist can do that nonfiction, it's very rare for it to happen, which is for the story to come to life. And all the people who do it in nonfiction, they use the techniques of fiction to do it. They do.
Right.
That's how they do it. And, but there's a gap.
Yeah.
Because you're relying on what he said or she said or whatever. When I put you there, you're sitting on Emil's shoulder or Adeline the whole time. And so you get it from their perspective in a very close perspective. And that seems to be the change, because I get letters all the time from people like, I've never, you know, read a history book. I thought it was the most boring thing until I started reading your books about World War II. And they became real to me, like what these people went through. And that's what I'm after. You know, I'm after people to have the same experience as the characters and to have learned from it. And you know, in the end, have a perspective on the entire situation that is surprising.
Right.
Right. And for Adeline, certainly. Emil, quiet guy, but, you know, he does very well in life. But for Adeline, every day after they get to Montana is a miracle. And she treats it as such. And that's remarkable.
It's remarkable.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot you can learn through this kind of historical fiction. I feel like it's often the most effective way for people to learn about what happened. Because you have nice notes at the end, you talk about things that really happened, you give even more context, yeah. And you bring up so many things that people can go and chase down. And that's where I loved it, because I feel like I learned so much about this point in history.
Yeah.
And then I was also able to understand and have this empathy. And I think that's what the kind of historical fiction we're talking about does. And I think just coming from a background where we know academia can be very off-putting, you know, shall we say, it just not dry. As engaging dry. And dry.
And this and- is, I mean, this is the worst thing that could have happened was I wrote a 140-page book of the facts.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No one would have cared.
Right, right.
You know? Right. And it doesn't
would have read it.
Right. It doesn't get that wider view. And Crystal, going into doing public history, and I felt like writing in a discipline, you're just writing for other members of the discipline. You're not really bringing
right.
this exciting. So we love what you do. Well, since this book has been published, you have a new book that's about to come out in May, and it's called All the Glimmering Stars. So just give us, with a little bit of time left, a sneak peek about the new book.
So All the Glimmering Stars is about two 14-year-olds in Uganda, a boy and a girl in the early 90s. And they live in these two different villages far apart, and they're raised with a lot of love in their life and a lot of guidance on how to be, for among other things, a good human. Anthony is the boy. He's a great runner. He excels at school. His father teaches him very early in life how to navigate by the stars. It becomes critical. And Florence, very good student, has measles as a child. It affects her greatly. She is raised by a mother who believes that there is nothing more powerful in the universe than the power of love. And both of them at 14 get kidnapped by this warlord, Joseph Kony, and along with 35,000 other children. And they get dragged into South Sudan, and he trains them to be child soldiers. And he effectively does it by training them worse than Navy SEALs. And I can say that because a Navy SEAL brought me the story. Originally.
It's incredible.
Yeah. And he attempts to dehumanize them to become soldiers. And both of them hold on to that thing that they had from their childhood. Deep. They don't admit it to anyone. They don't talk about it, anything. And 5 years into this horrific 10-year ordeal, Florence and Anthony meet, and they fall in love. And the power of love allows them to resurrect all those, you know, lessons that they were given as children about how to be a good human being. And they immediately understand how perverted and warped what it is that Kony's doing. But by reawakening the power of love and all these lessons, they were able to survive. They were able to escape.
Wow.
And then they're able to turn the tables on Kony. And Anthony actually becomes the chief witness against the Lord's Resistance Army at The Hague.
Wow.
And
that's huge.
It's extraordinary. And again, it's one of these stories when you meet them. You know, I went to Uganda with the Navy SEAL command, SEAL Team 6 commander, who's from Whitefish, who brought me the story.
Oh,
and
gosh.
And his partner, who was the CIA station chief in Kampala, who heard it first from Anthony. When they were all hunting Joseph Kony for President Obama. And they brought me the story, and I had never heard anything like it. And
That's amazing.
It is.
And so this comes out in May of 2024.
May 7th of 2024. Just about 2 months.
Oh, I can't wait to read it, to read that one as well. So this has been such a great conversation today, Mark. And so we highly recommend The Last Green Valley to everyone out there listening. We'll put it up. There we go. So where can folks find more information about this book, but also all your books and the new book that's coming out as well?
You can find, I have a website, MarkSullivanBooks.com. I am on Facebook. It's Mark Sullivan, author. You can find me at, and I don't do anything else.
All right. Perfect. That's great.
I barely do any of that either. So yeah, I feel it. Yep. I know. Well, thanks so much, Mark. And thanks to all our listeners out there for joining us today. And if you love this podcast or webcast, please tell a friend and make sure to subscribe so it shows up in your podcast feed each week live. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so people can find us. And thanks for listening today. And we hope you can join us again to find out more about
the dirt on the past. Thank you, Mark, for being here in person.
Thank you so much.
We really appreciate it. So a big thank you also to the Museum of the Rockies for the use of the studio space. And thanks to Ashley over in the corner there. Thanks, Ashley, for all your help. And also Chelsea Hogan, Michael Fox, and thanks to La Sinella Gria for mixing the music. Thanks all. Bye-bye. Bye.